Here we are. It's another Coaches Rising podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Today I'm joined by Adrian Wagner. He's a coach and facilitator at Complexity Partners. I'll say more about Adrian in a moment. So it wasn't long ago I saw Adrian posting on LinkedIn, and I was delighted to see that he's deeply immersed in the work of Dave Snowden, the complexity theorist and creator of the Kinevin model, and Thomas Hubel, who's bringing profound work into the world around collective trauma healing. Both of these two have had a huge impact on me. I've learned so much from them. And there are resonances, deep resonances in their work, and yet they're coming from different paradigms. What would they think of each other's work? So when I found Adrian, who's immersed himself both as a deep practitioner of each of their work, he really attends retreats and immerses himself in their work, and he's a researcher, I just thought this is an incredible opportunity to have this dialogue, to explore what are the resonances between their work and the seeming disharmonies or differences. So it was, for me, a very rewarding conversation to geek out in. So what's fascinating about this conversation too is that we explore Adrian's research report on this project he ran on trauma and democracy, which is a synthesis of Dave's and Thomas's work exploring novel pathways to integrate collective trauma. And I think it's fascinating to hear what unfolded. As I said, Adrian is a coach and transformational facilitator. He works with Complexity Partners. He's a teacher and researcher. He's also worked with the European School of Governance, the Foreign Ministry of Germany, the European Commission, and University Herdecke. So that all being said, let's dive right in. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey. So I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So Adrian, yeah, we're going to talk about the experiences we've had learning from two people, and I'm just really delighted to meet you, because as I was just saying to you that Dave Snowden's work has kind of rattled me and challenged me over the last few years, and Thomas Hubel's work I've just felt deep resonance with, and I've learned so much from both of them. And yet, you know, and there's obviously ways in which their work resonates, but there seems to be also like a dissonance between them. And so when I saw that you were quite immersed in each of their work, I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. So we're just going to have this conversation and see where it takes us. So how does that sound to you?
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, and great to invite me, Joel, because you know, like there are not so many people, I would say, who have that particular interest. And understanding one of them sometimes can be difficult enough. And bringing both together is quite a journey. It certainly has been for me.
Yeah.
And I think what moves me is really the possibility, you know, like to dance between complex thinking and the precise emotional attunement to hold the space for collective blind spots. I mean, that's what moves me, and that what, you know, like both of them if you bring it together, that's something that is deeply of interest and very much something I would love to explore further also with others like you.
Yeah. It's a real chance to geek out on stuff that I'm passionate about. I wonder if it's actually a good thing to do would be for us each to share, like, what did we learn from Dave and from Thomas that we found particularly valuable? Mm-hmm. And we can also move on after that to maybe explore like how their work connects, but where, what are these dissonances or seeming dissonances that there might be. But yeah, would you just tell me, I know each of their work is a profound and, you know, deeply nuanced kind of field of work, but yeah, I just trust you to be able to just tease out what are the headlines around what have you gotten from each of them that you particularly cherish?
So I think it goes back to my personal story when, you know, like with 23, I decided, like, I just met the integral theory and I decided to travel the Middle East. And, you know, in a certain way, I really hit reality with everything and the whole complexity that was there. And what stayed since then was definitely understanding much more about my own cultural background and the collective trauma, of course. And that whole topic of collective trauma that stayed with me. And meeting Thomas was actually the first one where I felt like he is, to a certain extent, embodying things. He's not talking about integral theory, but he's embodying something. And he really brings together spiritual work, but also trauma integration. And he has an understanding of the complexity of the collective. So that said, and years later, the possibility was provided, you know, like to really start studying with him and actually writing a PhD on his work on collective trauma. So, you know, I almost forgot about it. And suddenly that reappeared in my life. And I said, like, yeah, you cannot not do it. So I shifted my whole PhD program and started with him and also started to studying with him. And the key learning for me is that there is something where I'm talking about stuff and I can know a lot about stuff, or I can be with. I never heard Thomas talk about stages or states. And also when it comes to the collective trauma work that he does, it is always very much centered in the present moment and in the moment and the room. What do we feel? What do we sense right now? And, you know, like in the beginning, I was a bit naive. I thought, like, yeah, collective trauma, easy, very clear what it is. I just going to do interviews and then build a nice little theory. So I conducted around 50 interviews, 1.5 hours each, with participants of his first collective trauma training. And in that time, I suddenly came across a video of Dave Snowden. Where he basically, you know, like lashed out against everything, integral, teal wave, personal transformation, like the full on through a complexity lens. And I was already desperate because in the interviews I did, while there was a lot of value for the people, you know, like that I interviewed, because they had a relational space, they could reflect and everything, I realized that from a more scientific point of view, the term collective trauma, the best is that it functions as a metaphor. But there's like, it kind of like broke apart. I couldn't pinpoint anything. It actually became more confusing the more I listened to people and the different points of views. So while the practice of working with collective trauma and with Thomas was something where I really felt and could dive deeper, you know, into my own ancestral lineage, into my own collective, understanding it and formulating it became even more difficult to one extent, specifically within a scientific paradigm. And when I heard Dave talking, you know, like it created enough anomalies in my life where I felt like, wow, I mean, I have to look that up. I cannot ignore that, like not from a scientific research perspective. He has so many fantastic points, like retrospective coherence, like or how you build and make sense out of things, because you can connect dots, right? And we all the time do that. So if something happens, I can tell myself a story. It doesn't mean that that story is empirically proven, but it works for me. And if I tell it to others, it might work for others. And suddenly we have another myth. And that's not good science. And I was there, like bridging inner science and outer science and looking into, so how do we do that? And the thing is that when you look at complexity, the beauty of complexity is that we don't know. The beauty of complexity science, it doesn't say you can understand the whole picture. It doesn't say you can understand collective trauma and how it interlinks and everything, and then you just have a clear plan to solve it. It really brings you to that place within science to say, we don't know. Complexity is defined by you never know all the parts. So you can make assumptions, have fail-safe experiments, and take another step. And in practice, that's what also what I was seeing with Thomas and his work. Doesn't mean that everything that he does works out all the time. It makes like, but he's skilled enough as a facilitator to open a safe space and to take a next step to see what emerges and what comes. And how does it affect or shift the wider collective? I mean, in his case, groups up to a few hundred people or 1,000 people, even online. So, a little while down the road, I met Annika Sbari that I knew, from some time ago, second Integral International Development Conference. And I knew slightly that she was quite busy with Complexity Partners, which I'm now also part of. And Complexity Partners is basically the coaching company that really works closely with Dave in Germany and with Kenefin Company. And we met at the Metamodern Conference, where else? So I told her about my work, and she said, oh, cool, that sounds fantastic. And I said, yeah, I love what you're doing with the SenseMaker, like the tool that Dave uses. And suddenly we had a project, so we said, like, why not really using a sense maker to capture a process of collective trauma integration that Thomas facilitates? And so Thomas' work, I feel like you never know what comes out of it. It's like a black box. There is real emergence happening, like when he comes into a room and teaches. And at the same time afterwards, like people can go home and say, well, it was amazing and it was fantastic. But to some extent, it still stays a black box, right? I mean, do we really shifted something on a collective level? Like, how do we measure that? How can we show that? How can we show that to people who may be more inclined towards science and empiricism? So, long story short, so the idea was really to say, like, how if collective trauma actually is all of what we are not aware of and what we not feel, how can you then anyhow capture it? Because the moment you start talking about it, it's the question if that's really the issue or more of a symptom. So the beauty of the sense maker is that you can see the gorillas, right? I mean, that's the story that Dave always tells. Radiologists, they so focused on the cancer knots, they don't see the gorilla that is 48 times bigger. Only 17% see it. And I think in culture with collective trauma, that's the same. Like some of us are probably more attuned to it or have more of that in our lineages. So some of us feel and see it. But as it is with trauma, like it's implicit memory. It's something that you cannot verbalize. Like trauma is pre-verbal. So the moment we talk about it, it's usually not what the real issue is. So with the SenseMaker, you can collect micro-narratives. And that's what we did, like in a process with 350 citizens in Germany, together with the Pocket Project and an NGO called More Democracy. And we just asked a question, how do they feel as citizens in Germany? What story would they tell? So we didn't ask about trauma. like complexity principles. You want to do it obliquely. You want to see if it comes naturally out of the data. And then, of course, we built the signifiers, like the things where people self rate their stories with these triads and stuff like that. So the specific sense maker process. For example, you have a triad. Does your story has to do with the past, with the present, with the future? And out of that, of course, then you can go in and see, you first see the patterns, and then you can read the stories. And we did that before, during, and after. So we collected, I think, over 640 stories.
And does that before, during, and after doing the work with Thomas?
Exactly. So we had the collective trauma process online, 350 people. And before that, during that, and afterwards, we collected stories. And what is fascinating, I think, to see is, like we were working with democracy and trauma because it was just at the end of Corona. So originally we wanted to work to COVID and the response within the democratic landscape of Germany. Then the Ukraine war broke out. I mean, not funny, but we felt like, okay, now we need to open it up because it was very much coming into the consciousness. So we made it more broadly and not so much focused on one topic. And interestingly, what was very strong within the group was actually the reuniting or the of Germany, like the DDR and West Germany, East and West Germany. So that was a topic, for example, that came up very strongly in the process. We had no idea. Like it was not in our minds when we designed it. And it came up because we could see that in the narratives. Before we did that process, people would argue like democracy is something that is out there, it's institutions. After the process, people would see, look, I now understand that democracy is a relation. It's a relational quality as well. We would have people who would say, like, I don't trust media, I'm afraid. I don't know how to connect to media. And at the end, people would say, yeah, that fear and that disorientation, I know actually it comes because I grew up without a dad. And I can have as much information about Corona, it will not change that. I need to hold that differently. So what you could see is that on one hand, I mean, even 3 weeks after, we had 100 people joining Friday evening, to continue with us and see how to continue. Like they were really thrilled. I mean, online groups are usually not have such a high turnout on a free-to-free basis. So people were actually quite empowered, and we could see that in the stories, like the story landscape changed. And the beauty of it is, it's not that we say like there's some like a grand narrative in the beginning and a grand narrative at the end. But what we see is that the qualities of the stories shifted, of many different individual stories. And that was something, like that it took a lot of work. It was not an easy process. Like we had to deal with the politics and democracy. We had to deal with Thomas Hubl and the Thomas Hubl crowd. We had to deal with the sense-making crowd. And I really pushed the sense-maker because I felt like, oh, we need that. But I think it only 2 or 3 weeks before some people in the team realized what we could do with it. And I would say even now, like in the beginning of this year, we met in Germany with a bigger team with different projects around politics also in Europe. Only now we slowly, all of us still starting to unpack the potential that we have here. So yes, from Dave, definitely, how do we see the gorillas? And from Thomas, also definitely, how do I stay with what I'm not aware of? Now, how do I just stay to see what comes up? Because I think that is also a strength that Thomas brings, where he doesn't want to change. It's not about you need to change or you need to feel. It's really to stay with in the present moment long enough, and then emergence happens. I mean, that's the beauty of complexity.
There's so much in what you share. I want to bookmark the question about did Dave actually get to see the results of this sense-making experiment with the Pocket Project? Let's like hold that as a cliffhanger if you've
Yeah,
seen it or not.
sure.
But in the stories I hear you tell, I already hear like the relationality coming back online, like democracy's something out there, it's this fixed thing out there, but now suddenly, oh no, I'm part of the democratic process, or or that fear of the media is in me, and that speaks to me of the powerful work that collective trauma work can actually do, and what Thomas advocates for. It's fascinating to hear that. And so there's so many things I want to pick up, but like let me say a few things, and then we'll see where that takes us. Because that, what you're speaking about at the end here, about the emergence, about it's about dropping the change agenda, and you know, being with what's here and unfolding. That's what grabbed me about Thomas's work. I remember when I first came across it 15 years ago or something, and I heard him speaking about speaking online, you know, and he was talking about word and energy being connected, and it just electrified me in that moment. I was doing something, I was like, oh, like that's it. And I had the same feeling with integral theory. I was really into integral theory, and already we'd gotten kind of like, after about 3 years of being just like, holy shit, this is amazing, we all started to go like, but how do you live this? It's just really like theoretical, you know, it's like really abstract and, you know, weighed down by that. And so I've told this story on the podcast many times, but our route in was through a practice called circling, which again was like, it shares that in the central, one of the central principles is like you drop any change agenda and you just start to meet people as it is in the moment. You know, what's it like to be in connection with somebody? What are you feeling? What are they experiencing? And you that unfolds, you know, and there's no agenda to get anywhere. And suddenly we were like, wow, this is just an incredible experience. It's so fulfilling. So I love Thomas's work, and then I came across Dave, and I had the same experience with you, which was like, or similar, which was like, he was just challenging. You know, if people haven't seen Dave's posts on social media, you know, you just take a look, you know, it doesn't take him long to kind of, and I was confronted by that, you know, I was like, whoa, like he was challenging the importance of doing inner work, you know? And I'm really committed to inner work, and that's what this podcast is about a lot. And he was making these brilliant points, you know. So I found that I had to, rather than just kind of reject him because he didn't agree or he was challenging me, I found myself just consuming everything he'd written to kind of understand it more. And this is where I get back to, you know, to you in a moment. Like, you know, on the one hand, like the resonances I see are like the challenging the kind of hyper-individualized, isolated, kind of mechanical, abstracted view of experience where we atomize, you know, we atomize things. We separate ourselves from the being immersed in our relational experience in some way. And, you know, certain thinkers over the last few hundred years have compounded that with mechanistic worldviews. And so you know, this notion of like our relationality being at least as important as our individuality, you know, and even, you know, who are we on an individual level, really? And that experience of relationality, I see in Thomas's work too, where, you know, as one integrates, like my experience has been like, there's this taste of relationality which comes online. It's allowed more fully. And then both of them advocating for, you know, you don't try to get to some imagined close the gap, you know, from where you are now, which is wrong, and where you want to be, which is the idealized state, that being a problem, you know, and that's baked into a lot of coaching, you know. So there are now coaching approaches like Steve March, who have had on the podcast a lot, you know, who's talking about dropping the change agenda and unfolding by meeting what's here. And Thomas, of course. So that's where I feel like there's a really strong resonance for what they're advocating for, is that there's an intelligence that can come online, which is, you know, you couldn't plan for that. You don't know what's going to unfold before it unfolds. But then there are the dissonances. But I wonder for you, like, if we get a bit closer in, like, what have you found, like, is shared between what they're pointing at and, you know, what are the dissonances you're working with? What's your latest thinking about how their work really ties together?
Yeah, I absolutely can relate to that. So I would say it's like 1.5 years, 2 years. You know, like when, especially in that process, when we were setting up that collective trauma integration work with Thomas and with Dave's SenseMaker, I was torn apart. I mean, it felt physically. I felt like I'm being torn apart. You know, like I cannot bring together new materialism, and natural science with that mystic and his attunement practices. You know, like and I remember talking to a very dear friend and colleague of mine that I work with at the European School of Governance, Louise, who is also an action researcher, and we are meeting and co-reflecting often in our process, and she says, "Yeah, why not dance between the two of them?" And because I felt like I don't have a center, because of course, on a superficial level, you know, you could argue, yeah, Thomas is integral. Dave Snowden really doesn't like integral. You could argue, yeah, Thomas is into developmental models, and Dave really doesn't like developmental models. Thomas is really into inner work, and Dave says this is just, you know, narcissism. So on a superficial level, all of this creates a certain tension, and it was certainly I could feel the tension in my own. Like, do I need to make a decision or not? You know, what path do I want to follow? Also because I was training a lot in the Timeless Wisdom training with Thomas and in the core group, and I felt like, how do you bring that together? And at the same time, writing my PhD thesis, I felt like, yeah, I need to stay true to what feels like, you know, like the cutting edge of science, which to some extent is, and that's where it becomes interesting, which is much, like new materialism is much more non-dual than a lot of the inner work practices.
Just tell us what that is in an, because people listening might not know what that is. Yeah.
I mean, Andy Clark is certainly somebody who I can recommend if you want to read it. And it's certainly people that really let go of that individual notion. There's certainly an understanding that materiality is key. But there's certainly also a notion where consciousness and materiality is just deeply connected. And it's much more complex than, you know, like traditional mechanistic material worldviews. Like there's an awareness of that we don't understand a lot of things. And there's an awareness of in new materialism that, you know, like you're actually not that individual than you might feel. Like a lot of decisions are taken by our body constantly, you know, like depending in what environment we are in and what interactions we have with our environment and with our gut biology and all of those kind of things together. So there's a lot of subtlety in these philosophical thinking that you know, like for me at least, opening up a space to be more serious with like something like prior unity or a non-dual tradition. Because if you really take non-dual serious, I mean, even talking about inner work is already the Cartesian split, you know. So I mean, that's a bit off-road, but you know, like staying with the tension. You know, back in the time, I just started to get really excited about Brazilian souk dancing, which is a dance. Like, I'm not a natural born dancer, so you know, my partner was into it. She really loves to dance, and I challenged myself going into it, and I started to really enjoy it. And I started to, you know, even with some clumsy feet, getting a few steps, and the learning curve was increasing. And the metaphor for me really brought me back into my center, like that, you know, like when you have something like Brazilian souk, where you have a clear ground step, you have a lot of techniques, like you're moving in a certain rhythm, you know, like and that stays the same almost. And at the same time, like there's a lot of body movement, like there's a lot of flow, there's a lot of connectivity. And I felt like, well, I mean that, you know, like the crown, the base, what Dave brings in is really rigorous, thought through and provides you with a certain rhythm and a certain structure that allows you to stay grounded and also to scale. I mean, that's a topic for later, maybe. And at the same time, like the connection and the flow really comes in with the attunement by Thomas. And that, I mean, that metaphor, that image really helps me. And since then, I feel like it's more of like, how can we dance between the two of them? And at the same time, you know, it's not that we need to let go of all the things that you know, like the things that don't work between the two of them. I would say like it's quite healthy because that's also complexity. I mean, the coherent heterogeneity that Dave talks about, in my experience, that what happens when you bring the two of them together. On a first level, they might fight, but on another level, you know, like you could really bring something together to have change on large scale without staying in these kind of like change bubbles that we all experience and know, and without just having like a sense maker technical project, but really also bringing in attunement and resonance and knowledge around like experiential knowledge on collective trauma integration. So that excites me. I mean, bringing that together and dancing that dance. And at the same time, I think it really takes time to get it into the body. I mean, I still feel like it's still sinking in. It's not something that you can get in a workshop on a weekend, not with Thomas and also not with Dave. And I mean, but I guess that's the road we need to take, you know?
Yeah. This is brilliant. And I love getting into these more technical aspects of the resonances. Like Tibetan Buddhism, Tantric Tibetan Buddhism was a way that I started to make sense of the connection between their work as well, in the sense of, you know, just what I'm just going to, it's just another way of saying what you said, which is like, you know, breaking that notion that there's me, Joel, and I'm going to develop myself, you know, and I'm this kind of like independently existing entity, you know, that walks around the world with certain capabilities, and that kind of dissolving into more of a sense of like contextualized ways of being that arise, you know, in me as I'm in different contexts and environments with different people, you know, like energy states almost, like or certain ways, certain kinds of patterning that can arise that I can then work with skillfully, you know. Do I close down to this patterning, or do I open up to it? And it's not that there isn't a kind of sense of self, and that even I can grow my capabilities, because I obviously can, you know. It's not just that I'm, you know, completely enmeshed with the world and that it's completely dependent on my environment. There is like you know, an inner capacity which is evolving and opening, but it's just very different from what I, that notion that I held previously, which was, you know, was much more rigid and kind of a separate sense of, and I, you know, of self. And I agree, it's like a kind of almost like a mode of perception that like I'm opening to, where that sense of relationality can be something that's really experienced in the moment and in a vivid way, you know, even if it's like, even if there's a disharmony in that relationality. And that's maybe the most thrilling aspect, because there's a kind of a vividness and an enjoyment in life, a skillful means that opens up to be in relationality in a skillful way. So you could just respond to that, what I'm saying. But I'm also curious about, you said like Dave's work helps me with the ground and the base, you know, and Thomas's with the kind of attunement. Could you say more about that ground and base, like what that's like for you? And feel free to just riff off what I said if that feels inspiring too.
Yeah, I will try to do that in a bit of a metaphorical way. So, you know, like there's times where I love to free dance, you know, like you just take on music and you dance and it's fun and you move however you want to move, you know, ecstatic dance or these kind of practices. Yet when it comes to dances, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's tango or salsa or Brazilian souk in my way right now, you know, like you have enabling constraints, and you could say, this, I mean, why? why having a certain rhythm, why putting constraints on yourself where you need to learn for almost a year or longer technique, and you continuously need to learn technique. And in the beginning, you know, depending how good you are, it's not fun, right? I mean, so enabling constraints in dance, you know, like a certain rhythm, a certain beat, they form and inform a different movement. And that different movement has a different quality. And at least for myself, like, there's also a certain depth that comes with it. Like, there's a different grounding if I have a Brazilian soup dance than if I'm dancing free. Because my flow and my expression is always negotiating or dialoguing with the groundedness and my attention of the surrounding and the context. And in that way, I think that is something that works for collective trauma integration. You know, if we just do inner work, like, there can be a lot of stories that we tell each other. But if we do design collective trauma work processes, you know, and I'm talking about a level where it's maybe not so nice to say, but it's not about a bunch of hippies coming together and telling them stories and maybe even taking some ayahuasca and making something up, you know, like, that's where I think I really like Dave's critique, because we can, you know, like, we are really good in sense making and we are really good in telling us stories. The problem with social media and what we experience is we tell us awful stories and awful simplistic stories. And that's where you go down the rabbit hole with conspiracy theories. That's where you go down with polarization tendencies in societies. So how do we really look and go and grow a step deeper? So in that sense, I think the enabling constraints of natural science that Dave uses for his approach, I think, is very appropriate. But it doesn't mean he follows just a natural science approach. I mean, he uses them as constraints. And then at the same time, you know, like, if you bring those principles in that he talks about, you have a higher certainty that something grows out that really can handle complexity. So you have that attunement to the context, and you not just fly away. And at the same time, I think when you combine that with the work of Thomas, you also get that emotional attunement and flow to the voices that are not heard. And if you look at the second part of Dave's work, which is not just, you know, like, the natural science, it's also narrative. It's combining natural science as enabling constraints with narratives to create anomalies. So, and in that way, you know, like, if you look at Thomas' work, what he does is he sits together, he has a conversation, and usually you know, like, he senses into the implicit memory that you share with some kind of story that often is quite random. You tell him a story, I'm afraid of those news, I feel like we're living in a dictatorship. And then he says, wait a moment, I feel you. Can you feel me? Oh no, not at all. Oh yeah, now I can feel you. Oh, I'm scared and I'm young. And suddenly you realize where that fear comes from that is connected to a certain narrative. And suddenly maybe it goes even further back. And we saw those stories in our research. It goes even further back, you know, like, to the collective memory of Nazi Germany, where suddenly you realize, oh wow, I'm afraid that comes back. Reality looks totally different, but the narratives that need to be felt and spoken is the fear of, you know, like, fascist regimes and takeover and the loss of democracy. And that's a different story. And if these kind of things from the collective come and touch on the fear of a very young part in you, you know, like, I mean, that creates reaction, that creates trigger. And the beauty is, like, I feel like what Thomas does is that he helps people that, you know, like, a certain narrative that is coherent and in resonance with what you feel can land. And how powerful is that if then afterwards you just journal that into a sense maker? So for other people, and not to tell other people, oh, this is you, but for you to see, ah, this is how people feel and react. Yeah. So in that sense, it also provides a space where I can go. For example, a friend of mine, Judith, who worked with me on that report, Judith Strasser, she went with More Democracy into some of the eastern states in Brandenburg, and they just showed them their report. And the policymakers, if they see these kind of like narratives maps, they get it. I mean, if you go to them and tell them we want to do collective trauma integration stuff, like they will tell you, what are you talking about? But because they can read those stories and they can see the shift, especially in a policy level, like it's very valuable. And then you can, of course, have processes where you combine that.
I think I want to ask you more about enabling constraints in a moment, but what I find fascinating about what you're sharing now is that, one of the things Dave's been critical of are these, like the movements that have a sort of clear notion of like, this is where we should be, like we need a collective awakening. And it's, it's a vision, but it's disconnected from where we are now. And but when I hear you describing this kind of transformation, it feels like it brings together the best of both of what they're pointing to, in the sense of that, if we, I'm hearing from Thomas, like that we need to heal our collective trauma. That's one of the invitations of our times. And that if we do so, that will help us collaborate more, find new ways of being together. And what I'm hearing in your sharing here is that that seems like it's happening, but not through what I just said, not through saying this is where we need to be, we should be somewhere else, but actually by being with what's here, and then these narratives start to change, and then there's a kind of collective transformation that can occur, which feels like it would be more in resonance with how Dave would see transformation occurring. Maybe he doesn't even like that word transformation, but ch collective change, where that change doesn't even need to be conscious in large amounts of the population, or it's happening through these micro adjustments and micro narratives that proliferate. And so I don't know what you think about what I'm saying there, if that feels resonant or.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the and here again it comes down to the subtlety of language, right? And the subtlety, like of course, if you say like, oh, we need to integrate collective trauma, and then we already again in this kind of like linear thinking and doing mode. And to some extent, I think that is still something where I feel, Thomas is very clear that that's not the path, but there's still sometimes the language of that, or you could misunderstand that.
He
And in
doesn't
that.
say that stuff, does he? That's the key. He's very good at that. Like, not.
Exactly. Because the definition of trauma is an intelligent function. So if you look at trauma or collective trauma, I mean, trauma, collective trauma, I mean, a better precise definition is, like it's basically an event that was not processed within collective memory. So in that sense, what it becomes, and because you're born into your culture, it is a governing constraint from the start. And it's not something you want to get rid of, because it's a governing constraint to protect me from feeling 6 million people being killed in concentration camps. So I'm quite glad about that, So the question is rather, because we have so much unprocessed lived experience, because that is also what trauma is. I mean, trauma usually happens, you shut down because the experience is too much to feel, right? So we have all that implicit memory within our collective that is floating around, and we arranged to not feel that, which is quite intelligence, because that helps us to survive, and to some extent to maybe not to strive, but more to survive. So looking through a complexity lens, what Thomas is really good in, because what he does in groups is he usually brings it down. So what you do is in complex systems, you're not trying to see the bigger picture. You're trying to dissemble the assemblage. You're trying to go to those micro interactions. And that's what he does when he works one-on-one on people. And then he moves into triads, for people to co-reflect on it and share. What does Dave do? I mean, he works with triads as well. So there's a lot of similarities, I feel, when it comes, at least in Thomas' work, to the practice, in relation to to Dave's to Dave's work. And again, Dave sometimes has a language that is much more technical, much more rigorous, and my scientific self really likes that. And of course, Thomas, I feel like he's really pioneering something through an experiential approach, which I like as well. And I, so yes, you break down those interactions. You know, it's about interactions. It's not about individuals.
Right. And
And
that's the paradigm.
they're very strong. They're very strong, especially because of collective trauma, because they protect us. So there's a line of flight, or you could say like a path dependency that is very strong. And we usually don't want to go there because we first need the space and the safety to go there.
Amazing, amazing. That's just, you've just encapsulated to me the real beauty of like what I've learned from both of them, you know, that sense of it's about relationship, you know, like that's the enabling constraints thing. That what stayed with me was, so you gave the example of dancing, and that you know, different types of dancing have different types of enabling constraints. So the question's not quite fully formed, but it's like, therefore, is the practice to intentionally play with choosing different types of enabling constraints? You know, are we just saying that, well, actually, it's more about recognizing that different contexts have different enabling constraints, and therefore, you want to recognize what those are and you can work with them skillfully? And I'm just curious about how. Yeah, what are knowing about enabling constraints, like how you relate to them in a way? Like, are they just there? Like, but it, or is it something you can actually like play with and change in order to produce different results?
I would say absolutely. First, they are there. I mean, there's lots of, you know, like in, I mean, there's very good work on complexity that really goes into constraints that Dave builds on. And I mean, it's a bit of a technical word. It's not super sexy, you know, but at the same time, I think it's very fascinating once you realize, you know, like if I have my mobile phone open and quite close to my bed, it can easily turn into a governing constraint that doesn't enable certain things, right? If I might put the kettlebell next to the bed, that creates a certain enabling constraint. And if, especially if the mobile phone is further down. So what do I do first in when I get up in the morning? So I think it really helps us to understand that evolution works that way. So I wouldn't say just choose your governing constraint, but really look into what has evolution provided us with. You know, like again, trauma is a really, really intelligent function that has grown over millennia for us as human beings to survive. I mean, it's fantastic that we can just shut down, you know. And at the same time, while that is an enabling constraint to survive, it can become a governing constraint that is in the way to strive. So and that is, you know, like that is the work that I'm also kind of like think the latest work of Dave when it comes to estrogen mapping, you know, like where you actually you're looking at a system or a group or something, and you map those constraints and you see like what are the ones that take a lot of energy to change and a lot of time. Those are the most difficult one. And what are the ones that actually don't take a lot of time and not a lot of energy? And they can be also sometimes dangerous because they are kind of like the ones that let a system change very fast. And it's kind of like similar to like in estuarines where water flows in and out. So you have sandbanks, you know, like you have rock that is hard solid. You have all kinds of different constraints in such an environment. So you draw that from natural science and you bring that into a context where you work through an evolutionary lens. Similarly, like you, I mean, there's fantastic studies how bees or ants organize those days. And if we kind of like design our systems with these kind of principles that we find, you know, like we have a few hundred thousand years probably of evolution behind us. So the likelihood that we produce something that is better is much higher. So in that sense, I like where Dave goes with the natural constraints. And yes, you can recognize them, you can play with them, you can change them. And But the real issue is also finding out what you can change and on what level, because granularity is key. Like to breaking it down to the granularity, and that's also I'm sure you know that from coaching. You know, like I want to change your life. I mean, that's not something where you start as a coach. Like you would break it down. So yeah, tell me more. And where are you actually? And then suddenly, like micro shifts are maybe they don't sell as well as kind of like the super conscious awakening that happens tomorrow after a weekend seminar. But then at the same time, I think we are more and more moving into a direction where people realize we need something that works, not something that sells well, also in the coaching market.
Totally. And also, in coaching, recognizing about, that there are enabling and governing constraints, and that, you talked about Andy Clark. I think I know his work a little bit from the ex kind of extended self kind of, yeah, to include that inside of the coaching to support the changes that people are wanting to make and not just doing the inner work in inverted commas, And I think your point about that sense of inner and outer is actually a really beautiful one, isn't it? Because it's not a real existing distinction, Like it's useful in some way, perhaps, but actually, it has equally limitations if you really hold that to be true, So, yeah.
It still carries the Cartesian split, you know? I mean, it still carries that whole thing. And you know, like the interesting thing is that the Cartesian split to some extent was only happening because he wanted to safeguard science in relation also to religion to some extent. And so in that sense, you know, like there's also that question, how do we have that dialogue between more between our religious and spiritual beliefs and practices? Because again, Dave is a very, I mean, he is a religious man. I mean, he chose Catholicism as his path, and he convinced me in 1 minute about the depth of Catholicism in relation to non-dual and new materialism. You know, like if you really take Catholicism serious, like you're dealing with the material world, like spirit incarnated into the world. So there's even in Catholicism, there's this non-dual ground, and that goes very well together with new materialism that says you cannot make that mechanistic distinction between inner and outer. And that's where Dave comes from. You know, like I mean, so I hold that in a high regard, and he also is aware, and you know, like he knows about the different practices that you had in the Catholic traditions. I mean, the monks and the monasteries, they were designed in a way where you had different path and different enabling constraints to practice certain capabilities, you know. But I think often, and in that sense, I think we also need to be cautious, you know, like especially because you mentioned Andy Clark. I mean, there's so much that we act out unconsciously constantly that, you know, like having a serious practice takes time, and it takes like real dedication. You know, like in a Catholic practice, you had nuns that wouldn't talk for 10, 20 years. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, you know, like a 3 month meditation retreat is not, it's not that long, right? I mean, there are people that sit 3 years. So we need to be aware of those, let's say, like practices and how effective they are, and also what dedication it takes to really shift your perspective and your perception. And again, one point, I think also what Dave brings in, you can scale things, you know, like not everybody needs to take a workshop. I mean, you can to some extent, you know, imagine leaders coming together from different countries, Ukraine or Israel, and really going through a deep process with people like Thomas, and then at the same time collecting within their own environments massively stories from the ground, and then mapping what are the enabling and the governing constraints that doesn't help us to solve the conflict. And what can we do? Which are the ones that we cannot influence? Which are the ones we can influence? And how can we break that down to smaller and smaller steps? And then on a massive scale, have micro interactions. I mean, that's what I would love to see in the world. Yeah.
That tees up the question I, had about that I bookmarked earlier, which was, does Dave know about the project you've done with, the
Yes, I mean
project and
he shared it on LinkedIn. So and I think, I mean, I'm not sure if he fully read it. I'm very happy that we also were able to publish a United Nations University policy brief now. So he's also aware of that. And I think there's still a lot of learning for me in using the SenseMaker, but he's certainly aware of that. And also, like, I mean, working with Anne Kaspari in Germany, I mean, she went through the whole and the same process like we did. And I feel like she's, especially with Dave, a few years ahead. I mean, she works with SenseMaker since quite some time. So I feel like I'm not 100% sure how much he knows about it, but he certainly also didn't criticize it or anything, which I think I take that as a blessing already.
This is like, I don't know if Dave will listen to this, but
That's
we have this kind of comes from me. It's like, is this going to pass the Dave Snowden test? Have we created like an atomized view of leadership coaching that's got fixed competencies? So we've, but it's a kind of in-house joke. But actually, I'm really grateful for Dave for the challenges that he's brought, because it's improved my thinking and understanding immeasurably around this stuff. So,
same here.
I'm wondering, like, just as we kind of come to a close, like, in a few minutes, and I think maybe there's a part two. Yeah, I'm sure there is, because, like, what questions would you love to ask Dave and Thomas, or what is this? I'm just curious, like, what questions do you still have about how their work complements each other, or the dissonance? And like, would you love to bring them together in dialogue? And if so, like, what question would you ask them to explore first?
The first thing that comes up for me is certainly around memory. How do they feel? How do they feel? How do they describe memory? Memory also is something, I mean, Dave talks about it, that has a materiality to it. Like it comes into a space. It's not memory in that sense also carries a lot, especially memory and collective memory is something that I would love to engage more with both of them. Then there's still, for me, there's still a lot to reconcile around my own, like growing more up with integral theory and now jumping more into a lot of the philosophical background from Dave and new materialism. So around those issues, I still feel like a lot of question, like what is God for them would be an interesting question, I think. Like, how do they perceive or see God? What is God? I think there's a strong value also where does science stop and belief start? That is something that I would love to ask both of them. Like, where do you start to have religion or your practice, and where do you still stay with science, and how can that, is that something you can fully integrate, or is that actually something that you should leave to some extent in a tension, because only that can create the anomalies. So that is certainly something that I'm quite interested in. And there are lots of practical questions, like how do we really bring that together? I mean, we're working with a European pan-European party, like the World Party. They done well in the Netherlands and in Germany, and we basically what they read our report, and they wanted to set up like the European sensor network that is outlined in Dave's handbook of the field guide to managing complexity and chaos. So they are actually right now doing that, and there's more technically speaking, there's lots of questions how to bring that together. Yeah, and of course, to some extent, I guess I'm also, but that's more my philosophical side. Like I'm very curious by both of them as well around Heidegger and the lineage of Heidegger and how that plays out, especially with the term presencing that usually is associated with Sharmer, but Sharmer basically took that from Heidegger. And I think both Dave and Thomas both have a more Heideggerian understanding of how you work from the present with the evolutionary potential, how being comes into the world in the present moment. So there's something around that. Would love. I mean, so there are quite a few questions I think that come up around that as well.
Yeah, there's something about like Catholicism. I'd love to ask Dave about, because in some ways, Catholicism is a kind of dualistic religion, you know, in that there's, you know, this notion of God. So it maybe comes back to your question of like, what is God, you know? And that's what I appreciated about the non-dual, particularly Tibetan, not less so the Advaitic tradition, mm-hmm. more Tibetan, like that really feels resonant with this kind of notion of relationality, you know, as being a fundamental aspect of like a unity experience, you know, so that it's not just consciousness, but there's like matter and consciousness together, you know, like truly in unity, in diversity and unity. And yeah, I don't know how Christianity holds that, you know, it seems to be different.
It's the embodiment of the flesh. I mean, that's what Dave said, you know, like it's the embodiment of flesh. I mean, Jesus becoming like God, becoming the Son in the flesh and dying, that's the non-dual. Like it goes so much into materiality that even the Son of God becomes a human. So you have that. So in that sense, I mean, you know, like I think Dave is in that sense, what at least for me, like I got that intuition that Dave views Catholicism not as something that is separating. Yeah. He sees it much more like something that goes much closer to that embodiment, and that you need to deal with the material reality because that is God. You don't separate it. And that's already sin in his point of view. But I would love to go into some of those questions with him.
Because that's a bit, that's a whole other conversation, a journey I've been on around like a lot of spirituality in the West is very transcendent, you know, and it's like life denying in a sense. It's very sutric, and it's not like this imminent, you know, incarnated life affirming spiritual. I mean, in Buddhism a lot too, you know. So, hey, like Adrian, this has been fantastic, and you know, my wish is like I'm just curious who this conversation touches, and you know, maybe there are other kind of Dave Snowden, Thomas Hubel geeks out there who, you know, who might reach out. And anyway, I just want to just really appreciate the journey you've been on, and I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, same here. And I mean, who knows, maybe there's also possibility, you know, like to host at some point more calls. I mean, we'd be planning probably also something with complexity coaches, you know, like just to bring people together and move and play with those questions and with those approaches. So I think I would be excited about that. I'm very grateful and thankful for you, like listening and sharing that passion. You know, not all people appreciate it, but some do. So I'm looking forward to continue this.
Just actually let people know where they can find out more about your work and stuff. Yeah, I'm sure people will be interested.
Mainly on LinkedIn, or as well with complexity coaches. Those are the two things. I mean, LinkedIn, Adrian Wagner, that's the easiest. And then, of course, also with complexity coaches, you find me.
All right, cool. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And Just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.